content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. I'm going to be reading from Volume 64, Number 1, Carolina Critters, Animals and People in North Carolina History. It's the Fall 2024 edition. I'm going to start with one of the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine article contest winners. This time it's in the secondary division, and it's Matthew Peluso. Is a member of the Peluso Junior Historians, Peluso Christian Academy, New Bern, Don Peluso Advisor. He was the winner of the 2023 Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine Article Contest Intermediate Division, and his article is titled, Hogging the Market. For hundreds of years, North Carolina has had a deep connection to the pork industry and growing pigs. While many years have forced huge changes in technology, people, and systems, even though the many changes in how our market has grown, some things still remain the same. North Carolina's dedication to growing pigs. In the early colonial period, European settlers began to introduce some of the first domesticated pigs into the North Carolina area. Known for their sharp noses and spines, these razorbacks were often ear-notched before being released to run free and forage until they were collected, returned to their owners, and finished in the fall. Many of these pigs were strictly for survival and consumption, as the intersellable market was barely a concept with pork of this scale. Through the late 1700s and early 1800s, the turn in the market began its journey in North Carolina toward larger-scale hog farming. Early farms were beginning to understand selective breeding, breed ratios, and growing better pigs. These small family farms mostly aimed to grow a few extra pigs to add some cash to their pockets and provide more opportunities on their farm. It was not until later that the shift really swung toward a full-scale hog grower farm. In the late 1800s came the Industrial Revolution and the ever-growing demand for fast-grown protein in large quantities to ship to cities and across the country. This is where North Carolina began to shine, with many farms ever-expanding to bigger and bigger markets, bringing more hogs to market, and beginning to set the stage for the hog revolution of the next century. Many of the developments from this era studied by North Carolina State University, such as selective breeding, better feed practices, and farmer education, were key players in developing the market we know today. Following the turn of the century and moving through the early 1900s were some of the largest advancements in hog technology and some breakaways, such as the housed floor method, better genetics, better vaccines, and feed advancements. Many of these factors combined, and we started to see the steady growth and corporatization of the hog industry. As the industry began to see rapid expansion in production, there also began to be a rapid decrease in the number of farms, leaving many people to wonder what the future of the small family farm was to look like. One of the leaders in integrated hog development in the state of North Carolina was Wendell H. Murphy of Duplin County. Murphy started in the early 1970s with his first feed mill and farm, using a $10,000 loan from his father. Murphy soon began producing enough hogs to close his mill to the public and began supplying his farm and his contractors with feed without selling publicly. His mill, now named the Chief Feed Mill, is the largest single feed mill in the world, producing hundreds of thousands of tons a month. As Murphy began to gain more power in the hog world, he decided to run for the North Carolina House of Representatives, where he served during the 1970s and 80s and pushed a series of pro-farm bills known as Murphy's Laws. Many of these laws helped farmers expand their hog operations amid many problems regarding sewage, runoff, contamination, and smell. As this continued, the population of hogs in North Carolina also continued to grow, rising from 1.9 million in 1977 to nearly 10 million in 1997, placing North Carolina in the top pork states in the world. The number of farms hit a drastic fall during that same period, falling from nearly 19,000 to a mere 3,000. As the excitement of all these issues, stories, and growth began to slow, Murphy made a huge decision to sell out his farm company, now worth nearly $500 million, to the quickly growing pork giant Smithfield Foods, based in Smithfield, Virginia. After the sale, he joined the director's board of Smithfield to continue to help farmers grow hogs in the state of North Carolina and produce record numbers of pigs in the early 2000s. Throughout the many years that North Carolina has been involved in the pork market, many things have changed. The once popular small family pork farm continues to morph into a giant industrial machine responsible for nearly 30 million hogs per year shipped across the world. Even with this turn, however, we still see some of the same drive as faced forever, to be the best producer in the world and to be the best at it, to continue to innovate and learn from the past, to live better in the future, and to prepare for the future. The next article is Vampires of the Forest by Sidney Raynone, who is a park ranger and educator at Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Almost 30 years ago, a dangerous invader arrived in North Carolina. It swept through the mountains and forests, killing thousands of eastern hemlock trees and endangering the homes of many forest creatures. Scientists have been working for decades to fight this animal and save our forests. What animal could be so destructive? You may be picturing a large predator like a bear, or even smaller pests like rats or mice. But this creature is much, much smaller. Looking at a group of hemlock woolly adelgids, adelgids, you might not even think that they are animals at all, but they are tiny insects called aphids. Aphids is a group of small, soft-bodied insects that eat by sucking the juices out of plants. Groups of these pests look like little cotton balls at the base of needles on hemlock trees. One single hemlock woolly adelgid, HWA for short, could fit on the tip of a sharpened pencil. Small, under 1 millimeter long, but deadly, these animals are on North Carolina's most wanted list. By exploring their history, we can learn how they got here, why they're so dangerous to our forests, and what we can do to help. Hemlock woolly adelgids are an invasive species. Invasive species are organisms that invade our country, that come from somewhere else in the world, and cause harm to native plants, animals, and ecosystems. HWAs are originally from Japan. The first hemlock woolly adelgids found in the eastern United States were reported in 1951 near Richmond, Virginia. These insects can't crawl far on their own, but they can hitch a ride with flying birds, the wind, and most commonly on trucks delivering non-native plants like decorative trees and shrubs. The first HWA arrived in North Carolina in 1995, and in just 7 years, it spread to every county in the state that has hemlock trees. How can such a small critter cause such a big problem? The HWA uses its mouth to attach to the needles at the ends of branches. Then it sucks out the stored nutrients that the tree produces, like tiny hemlock vampires. One adelgid wouldn't be so bad, but millions of them can infest a single tree. Together, they can kill an adult hemlock in as little as 4 years. The trees the HWAs target are incredibly important to our forests. Eastern hemlock trees are some of the oldest and largest trees in the Great Smoky Mountains. They can live for more than 500 years and grow to be more than 150 feet tall. Their dense needles also create large areas of shade to keep our rivers a few degrees cooler, which is what our native brook trout need to survive. People in North Carolina have been using the hemlock tree for hundreds, maybe thousands of years. The Cherokee people have historically used parts of hemlock trees as medicine for kidney or skin ailments, and the bark of these trees is still used in basket making today. These trees were also an important source of money to local communities during the logging era of the Smokies. From 1901 to 1939, the Little River Logging Company harvested hundreds of thousands of trees, employing many locals. However, concerned citizens began to worry about the future of the mountains, and many activists like North Carolina resident Horace Kephart campaigned for the land to be protected. In 1926, the U.S. government decided to act, and in September of 1940, President Franklin D. Roosevelt opened the Great Smoky Mountains National Park to the public. Over the last 80 years, the forests of the Smokies have begun to recover from logging. Most of the national park is forested, including more than 3.5 million eastern hemlock trees. The HWA is a newer threat to these trees. But how can we fight an enemy that gathers by the millions? Well, have you ever had to give your dog or cat medicine to deal with fleas? One of the ways that we are fighting the HWA is by injecting trees with that same kind of medicine. This chemical helps the tree to keep HWAs away for up to 10 years, kind of like a tree vaccine. If you're ever walking through the national park, and you spot a colorful dot painted on the trunk of a hemlock tree, that means that tree has been treated. Great Smoky Mountains National Park has also been fighting back by releasing predator beetles, other insects that can find and hunt the hemlock woolly adelgids for us. These beetles are one of the HWA's original predators from Japan, and they only eat HWAs in our forests. That's what makes them safe to release. Using these methods, our team has already saved more than 300,000 hemlock trees inside the national park, and the good news doesn't stop there. Most of the trees that were saved are adults that are creating new hemlock seeds all the time, starting the next generation of forests. The HWA is a little big problem, but we have so many groups actively fighting to preserve our forests, including the North Carolina Department of Agriculture, the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, the U.S. Forest Service, North Carolina State Parks, Great Smoky Mountains National Park, the University of North Carolina Asheville, the Hemlock Restoration Initiative, and many more. Together we can help our hemlocks and protect our forests for future generations. Here are the captions accompanying the photographs in this article. Can you tell the healthy trees from the trees that have been destroyed by the sap-sucking hemlock woolly adelgids? The logging industry brought jobs to the mountains of North Carolina in the early 1900s, driven by the Industrial Revolution. Loggers would cut down trees and take them to mills, often using oxen or mules. The mills processed the wood into lumber for building homes and businesses. Logging also helped fuel the development of North Carolina's furniture industry, providing quality hardwood for factories in High Point, Hickory, and elsewhere. Is that snow on a hemlock tree? No, it's thousands of hungry hemlock woolly adelgids munching on the branches. Electron microscope image of a single woolly adelgid. The next article is 50 Wild Years at the North Carolina Zoo by Jane Owen Parker. A lover of wildlife, nature, biology, and dogs, Jane Owen Parker has worked at the North Carolina Zoo Society for nearly 30 years after logging 4 years working in the education section at the zoo. There are a couple of words to know for this article. Zoo is a place where animals, especially wild ones, live in captivity and are put on display for people to view. The word zoo is short for zoological park. And habitat. Habitat is the natural environment or home of an animal or plant. On August 2, 2024, the North Carolina Zoo celebrated its 50th anniversary. On that date in 1974, then-Lieutenant Governor Jim Hunt dedicated and opened an interim North Carolina Zoo. At the time, it was not much to look at. confined inside a mere 21 acres, it housed about 250 animals. Some peered at guests through chain-link fences. Others lived behind glass in a small exhibit building. As meager as it was, the zoo still stirred excitement and hope at the opening ceremonies. All the guests understood that a modern, remarkable zoo would follow. The promised zoo would become the first United States zoo to house all of its animals in natural environments, instead of cages. That commitment to animal welfare would set it apart from all the zoos that came before it. This zoo would, in the words of its original architects, express the highest ideals of our society: diversity, freedom, compassion, and respect for nature. The zoological park will be as concerned for the animals' welfare as for the visitors' pleasure. Fulfilling its promises, the zoo's early commitment to natural habitat design and animal welfare set it on course to become one of the world's most respected zoos. In its early years, the zoo's spacious, authentically landscaped exhibit clusters wowed its visitors and earned quick accreditation from the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. This national nonprofit group sets the gold standard for animal care in North America's zoos and aquariums. These standards require zoos to pursue legitimate missions in conservation, education, and research while carefully attending to the health and well-being of their animals. A zoo must pass a multi-day on-site evaluation every 5 years to keep its accreditation. The North Carolina Zoo earned its first accreditation in 1973 and has continually maintained it. Here are the photograph's captions. The zoo's wild animal science camps give young budding scientists hands-on experiences that mimic the field work that conservation scientists undertake in the wild. A polar bear takes a swim. Adult polar bears are usually solitary. The zoo makes two habitats available to its pair of polar bears to give the bears plenty of space to be alone when they choose to be. Dr. Jane Goodall, the world's most famous expert on chimpanzees, made several visits to the North Carolina Zoo in the 1980s. The zoo participated in ChimpanZoo, Dr. Goodall's study of chimpanzee behavior. The study compared chimp behavior in the wild with behavior of chimps living in zoos under human care across the United States. Who's looking at whom? Lions lolling in the sun at the zoo. And there's a sidebar article, Some Famous Animals from North Carolina Zoo History. Downward dog? No. Elephant leg lift. Have you ever seen an elephant do yoga? As of 2024, Cesar is the oldest African bull elephant living at the North Carolina Zoo and one of the oldest in the United States. He came to the zoo in 1978 when he was just 4 years old. In 2019, staff noticed that Cesar's sheer size, 12,000 pounds, was taking a toll on his body. So they started him on yoga to help with his range of motion. Slow and steady wins the race. Three visitors admire Tort, a Galapagos tortoise in 1974. In 2024, the zoo installed bronze statues at the North American entrance to honor Tort and his companion Retort, who were the first two animals to arrive at the zoo 50 years ago. Next article is Red Wolves in North Carolina by Katerina Ramos, who is the Red Wolf Education and Outreach Coordinator for the North Carolina Wildlife Federation. She runs the Red Wolf Center programming in Columbia. Learn more at redwolfcountry.com. North Carolina stands as a pillar of knowledge in the history of the Endangered Species Act. Our state is known for the Red Wolf Reintroduction Program, which has been a piece of conservation history many do not know. The program was the first time a species was reintroduced after previously being declared extinct in the wild. It became the blueprint for other reintroduced animals, such as gray wolves in Yellowstone National Park. In 1987, eastern North Carolina was chosen for the first Red Wolf Reintroduction Program. It is located within the historic range of Red Wolves, which included the southern parts of New York and Pennsylvania, down the East Coast, into Florida, and west into Texas and Oklahoma. The Albemarle Peninsula area was chosen because it was a peninsula, generally had a lower density of roads and people, has large amounts of federally owned land that is managed for wildlife, and at the time did not have coyotes present. In September 1987, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service released four pairs of red wolves onto Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge. The next year, the first litter of red wolves was born since the species was declared extinct in the wild in 1980. The program continued to grow until the wild population hit approximately 120 red wolves in the early 2010s. After the early 2010s, however, red wolf populations declined due to steadily increasing coyote populations and gunshot mortality. At times it can be difficult for people to tell the difference between red wolves and coyotes. And during this time, red wolves had black tracking collars. The rate of gunshot mortality for red wolves increased due to this mistaken identity as human conflict with coyotes rose. As more red wolves were lost, it became harder for red wolves to find other red wolf mates. Over time, they began to pair with coyotes as a last resort. This has been a major concern because of the genetic risks of hybridization when two different species of animals breed and create a new hybrid animal. Since 2000, the Red Wolf Recovery Program has been working to reduce hybridization through a coyote sterilization program. Under this program, captured coyotes are sterilized, which means they can no longer reproduce. Then they are re-released into their territory. But because they remain hormonally intact, they continue to defend their territory against other coyotes. However, when a red wolf pair moves into the area, they will displace the coyotes. Research has shown that this management technique is successful at significantly reducing hybridization between red wolves and coyotes. In 2019, the National Academy of Sciences confirmed that the red wolf is a distinct species. In 2020, the known redwood population in the wild reached a low of 7 individuals, which is the number of radio-collared red wolves that are tracked on the landscape. However, release of adult red wolves born in captivity resumed in 2021 to try and increase the population and genetic diversity. In 2022, the U.S. Department of the Interior and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced a recommitment to the recovery of the red wolf, and in September 2023, a revised red wolf recovery plan was issued. In 2020, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service started using only bright orange tracking collars on red wolves to help identify them as a protected species. Currently, all known adult and juvenile red wolves have orange collars. However, pups of the year are too small to be collared yet and are more easily mistaken for coyotes. Orange reflective material on the collar helps the red wolves become more visible to cars at night. Getting hit by cars was the second leading cause of mortality since reintroduction. However, over the last 10 years, it has become the leading cause. The current known population of red wolves in the wild is 17 radio-collared individuals. The Red Wolf Recovery Program is continuing to work toward the recovery of the species, along with many partners, and has high hopes that one day there will be a strong population of red wolves in the United States again. Here are the captions accompanying the photographs of the article. In September 1987, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service released four pairs of red wolves onto Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge. The very next year, the first litter of red wolves was born since the species was declared extinct in the wild in 1980. A service biologist holds a red wolf pup that will be fostered into a wild litter. People are working hard to protect red wolves in the wild. One effective method is fitting wolves with reflective orange tracking collars. Another is posting neon roadway signs alerting motorists to drive carefully in red wolf territories. Here's a closer look at more of North Carolina's state animals. The state horse is the Colonial Spanish Mustang, selected in 2010. Colonial Spanish mustangs have roamed wild and free along the Outer Banks for more than 500 years. DNA confirms that they are descended directly from Spanish horses and were probably brought here by Spanish explorers in the 1500s. These horses are known for their ability to survive tough weather, including hurricanes. Today, there are only about 100 wild horses left. But the Corrala Wild Horse Fund works to preserve their habitat and educate the public. Fun fact, students at Shawboro Elementary School in Currituck County helped campaign to make them a state symbol. The state salamander is the marbled salamander, selected in 2013. You can identify the marbled salamander, Ambystoma opacum, by the white and gray marbled patterns on its black body, if you can find it. This salamander grows to about 3.5 to 5 inches in length and is mostly nocturnal, meaning it is active at night. So it often hides under logs or leaf litter during the day. Fun fact, at age 14, Raleigh teenager Rachel Hopkins successfully campaigned to name both the marbled salamander and the Pine Barrens tree frog as state symbols to raise awareness of amphibian conservation. Speaking of which, the state tree frog is the Pine Barrens tree frog. It's also selected in 2013. The brilliant green Pine Barrens tree frog, Hyla andersoni, is native to the pine forests and sandhills of south-central North Carolina. It is known as one of the most beautiful frogs in the United States. This frog has a purple stripe bordered by white along each side, with bright orange patches under its legs. Maybe you've heard its distinctive honk or quonk mating call on a dark summer night. Unfortunately, this amphibian is a threatened species in our state. Populations are declining due to habitat loss. Fun fact, the Pine Barrens tree frog is tiny. It only grows to 1 to 1.5 inches long. The state fossil is the teeth of the Megalodon shark, selected also in 2013. Megalodon, a Totus megalodon, was the largest shark ever to swim in the oceans. This huge predator ate whales, sea lions, and sea turtles. It could grow up to 60 feet long, and it lived to be nearly 100 years old. Megalodon became extinct more than 2 million years ago, but its big bite is still remembered in our state. Beachcombers can find fossilized megalodon teeth along the Carolina coast, particularly after storms. Fun fact, Donna Jones, is a teacher at Newport Middle School in Carteret County, came up with the idea to make it a state symbol as an 8th grade science project. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.